Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host. I'm happy to be able to offer a new program this summer, an Antinomian Hour. The program consists of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is Professor William Bauer, Jr. Professor Bauer is an associate professor of history at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where he teaches classes on California Indians, American Indians, and the American West. He's also the UNLV liaison to the Newberry Libraries Consortium on American Indian Studies. Professor Bauer is author of We Were All Like Migrant Workers Here, Work, Community, and Memory in California's Round Valley Reservation, 1850 to 1941, that was published by the University of North Carolina. His current research includes using oral history to offer alternative tellings of California Indian history. I see he's also done a study, Growing Old in Indian Country, and he's published many articles and book chapters. Bauer is a Wailaki and Kankau of the Round Valley Indian tribes, and he grew up on the Round Valley Reservation here in Mendocino County. Some listeners will remember his talk at the Mendocino Institute's Ecology and Community Conference broadcast here on KZYX. We're extremely lucky to have him back, especially now. He's in the midst of back-to-school time. So let's begin. Good afternoon, Professor Bauer. Great to have you back.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be back on the air.
Oh, great. And it's I'll call you Willie. Is that still what you like?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That sounds great.
Okay. Well, let's just jump right into this. And tell us a little bit about the trajectory of your work, because you've been doing history and I think also with an emphasis on oral history. So how did you get into that? Where does that come from?
Well, from the beginning of my academic career, I've always believed that it's important for scholars to use and incorporate American Indian voices American Indian voices into their understandings or their tellings of history. When I was, a graduate student and even an undergraduate student, I was always struck by the fact that very few Native voices, Native peoples, spoke or in books and articles about the American Indian past. And so I made a commitment to use and include oral histories in any kind of research project that I would do. And since I grew up on the Round Valley Indian Reservation, I knew that my first research project, the book that I wanted to write, had to deal with some aspect of Round Valley's history. And I knew, of course, that I wanted to interview people such as my grandmother and my aunt and other people from the Round Valley Reservation to get their understandings and their readings on the past. I've always kind of thought it very important that we hear, the voices of grassroots people, kind of these kind of bottom-up, or how we call them, bottom-up histories, rather than thinking about what presidents and kind of political leaders think about and talk about all the time. What do everyday people think about, and how do they kind of understand their past experiences? And so for my first book project the title of which is We Were All Like Migrant Workers Here. I interviewed a number of people on the Round Valley Indian Reservation, and one of the things that really stood out there was that they all had these memories of working as migrant workers throughout Mendocino County. The primary job that all of them remembered doing was picking hops in the area. And so that kind of got me to kind of gravitate and move to think about what does work and labor mean, what does work and labor mean from a Native perspective. And so the title of the book comes from an interview that I had with someone on the reservation. And I really tried to allow those oral histories to guide the book. I mean, not only did I want Native voices, right, to be in the book, and and carry the narrative, but I also wanted to have Native people, the words of Native people, kind of interpret how they understood their past experiences. So it's one of the kind of the arguments or one of the ideas that I've left that book with was that not only do Native peoples kind of tell about their past experiences, but they also interpret them. They kind of invest meanings in what they had done in the past. And so that was, you know, that was kind of my first foray into using oral histories and oral narratives. And now I'm currently working on a project entitled Indigenizing California History. My first book had a very kind of long, turgid title, so I tried to find as short of a title as I possibly could for this one. And so in Indigenizing California History, what I'm trying to do, what I'm attempting to do is to use a cache of oral histories and oral traditions that were collected during the Great Depression to offer an alternative understanding of California's history. And so what California Indians do in the 1930s is that when they tell these oral histories and they tell their oral traditions, they're doing three things. They are, you know, they're explaining or they're interpreting their past experiences. They're trying to explain their present circumstances or those circumstances that were going on in the 1930s. And they're also imagining their future in the state. And so those are some of the kind of the issues that I'm trying to wrestle with this current project.
Okay, so when you say alternative, in a sense, you're engaged in a challenge of the official historical record. Is that fair?
Exactly. I mean, we've probably all sometimes have run across those kind of great the so-called kind of great California historians like Bancroft and a host of others. And you know, in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, they wrote kind of these large or long narrative histories of California. And very often, these histories of the state made interpretations about America, about California Indians, that tended to kind of justify what had happened, right? So they would justify the dispossession of California's indigenous peoples, right? The taking away of land, the Indian wars that occurred in the 1850s and the 1860s. They also kind of justify and explain from Bancroft's own perspective, for instance, the removal of indigenous peoples from their homelands to reservations that are scattered around the state. And so when California Indians told their oral traditions, I mean, I make the point that they are kind of confronting that kind of standard historical narrative that Bancroft and others that others put forward. For instance, one woman, her name was Lucy Young, who's a rather famous or well-known California Indian woman, LASIK woman from Northern California. She said this in her oral history. She said, quote, "If you could only know the truth of that the Indian has been treated since the first white man came into California, it would make an ordinary man shake and shudder. I would like to tell you the whole story from 1846 up to the present date, but I'm afraid it would not be allowed to be put in print." And so she's very conscious of her efforts to kind of retell this history of California. But I think also what she's aware of are these kind of power relationships that she's worried that her voice or her interpretation of the past isn't going to be widely accepted. And so one of the things that I want to do with this current project is to make sure that California Indian understandings of the past, present, and future get equal status with kind of non-Indian historians of the state.
Just a word about her again. Who and where?
Oh, her name was. I'm sorry.
No, you did. But
okay. Well, Lucy Young was a kind of a well-known LASIK woman in Northern California. She eventually came to live on the Round Valley Indian Reservation. She worked with a variety of anthropologists and botanists and a whole group of people, kind of sharing kind of LASIK culture and especially kind of LASIK understandings of plants in Northern California. So she was well known throughout a number of circles. People have used other people kind of interviewed her and have published her life story in different kinds of in different kind of contexts.
Okay. And you must run up against the sort of fetishization of the empirical record in this kind of work. Is that a problem to rely on oral history? Or maybe you could say something about the challenges of using oral history.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, history as a profession has always kind of relied on the written word or in written documents. You know, many of the things that historians use to write about the past all have to be kind of transcribed or written down. For instance, in my work, I tended to rely on government reports that were produced by government agents on the Round Valley Reservation. Other people have used diaries or newspaper accounts, but anything kind of written down. And, one of the reasons why historians tend to trust what has been written down is that there's a sense of permanence. Mm. Right? Once you write something down on a piece of paper, as long as it's preserved and kept, that document or that source remains, it exists forever. Or it's there. One can go back to it and look at it and test one's other hypothesis against the arguments of another scholar. So there's always been that kind of reliance on written documents from the perspective of historians, and other historians have tended to distrust oral histories and oral narratives because they argue that they might change over time. If we did this interview tomorrow, no doubt I would tell these narratives and tell the stories very differently. But this interview is transcribed, there's kind of a permanence to that story. And so that's one of the reasons why oral histories have tended to be distrusted in academic circles. And sometimes I kind of feel that's too bad. And the main reason is. Written narratives and oral narratives all are kind of influenced by the person either writing the diary or telling the story, and they bring their own interpretations and their own kind of perspectives into those documents. And so actually, aside from there, so I think that there's more similarities between these two sources than many people kind of typically consider.
Right, and the official record keepers don't always tell the truth, do they? And
exactly, no.
Sometimes they lie.
Exactly right. Government officials, for instance, who are working on reservations often tended to paint a rosier picture of what was going on because their job depended on showing some kind of progress. Mm. For instance, they might say, in year one, we planted 100 acres of wheat, and then in year two, they'll say, well, this year we expanded our acreage to 150. They may not be doing any of that at all, but they have to kind of justify why they have their job and why they want to kind of keep their job. And so so written sources can be manipulated and changed as much as some of the oral stories or oral narratives and oral histories can. And, both of these sources have their flaws, too. I think that's something that I understand that oral histories might not be giving kind of a quote-unquote accurate view of the past, but that view of the past is vitally important to understanding how California Indians understood their position in 1930s California.
Hmm. Yeah, we might think about what kind of a idea we'd have about this past summer in the world, if we just listen to
CNN. Right. It's we would, and very often the written records are going to tell a very different story than our memories and our oral stories about it.
And what about the public works projects? Maybe you could just tell us a bit about what exactly they are, and there are probably some problems working there. Who were the people that did these histories, and how did could you say something about how they went about the task? It sounds like it might have been quite difficult.
Absolutely. It's actually kind of one of the reasons why I really got into this project. So all of these oral histories and oral traditions that I found were collected in 1935 and 1936 as part of a state public works project. It was the State Emergency Relief Act that kind of provided the funding for this work. And so the anthropologist Alfred Kroeber, who taught at the University of California, Berkeley, secured a State Emergency Relief Act grant to conduct ethnographic or an oral history interviews in four parts of the state. One part was Mendocino County, and the second part was the Owens Valley of California. He also wanted to do one in northeastern and in northwestern California, but he didn't get funding for those two projects. So right there, we can see perhaps a kind of a flaw in it in some of the sources. We only have the only surviving sources that we have are those that he received funding for. And so I'm basing much of this work on these interviews that his graduate students did in Mendocino County and in the Owens Valley. Kroeber sent couple of his graduate students to these areas, and kind of one of the interesting things about this project that makes it different than, say, another project that I'll talk about here in a second, is that Kroeber purposely talked about in his grant application that he wanted to hire both older Native peoples to tell the stories, to tell the oral traditions and oral histories, and he wanted younger people on the reservation and in these Native communities to act as interpreters and transcribers. So, for instance, my great-grandfather, who was named Charles Wright, was interviewed as part of this project. And so he was hired by the anthropologists to provide the ethnographic information. And then my great-aunt, Eva, was hired to act as the interpreter and the transcriber. And so very often, younger Native people were asking the questions to these older Native peoples. And so I've seen this throughout these interviews, is that the older Native peoples very often determined the course that the interview took. I've seen it written down that, well, people will say, for instance, well, this story is on my mind this morning, and so this is why, and I'm going to tell it to you. And so they very often took control, and these elderly Native people had the power to determine the course of the interview and what was being transcribed and written down. This is very different than the other more well-known public works project. I mean, maybe some of the listeners are aware that during the Great Depression, there was the WPA slave narratives in which people were hired to interview elderly African Americans primarily in the South. And get their perspectives on what it was like to be a slave in the 1860s, and then also their understandings and their experiences in Reconstruction and Jim Crow America. The problem, though, I think, that scholars have noted about those interviews is that very often there were for lack of a better word, white interviewers working with African-American, elderly African-American peoples. And so there was these different racial dynamics. Indeed, there's actually been discovered that one of the people, one of the WPA interviewers, was descended from a slaveholder who owned one of the people that this person was interviewing. So there was these kind of very difficult kind of power relationships that existed in the WPA narratives. Luckily, because of the way in which the interviews that I've been working with were structured, where you have younger Native people interviewing older Native people, I really think there's kind of more of an organic understanding or organic development here, where Native peoples are taking control of this pace and the scope of the interviews.
And these interviews are found in the Bancroft, or
yes, these interviews they were written down, and then they were stored in the Bancroft Library.
Well, I have to pause here for a minute. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program today is an antinomian hour, and our guest is Professor William Bauer, Jr. He's a history professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and talking to us today about his work and writing. Just before, I guess, we shift subjects, you also seem to emphasize the place of work in your histories. Maybe you could tell us why you think work is important. Sometimes it's treated as sort of mundane, uninteresting, beside the point, but not for you.
Oh, no, I'm not really. I have a couple of reasons why I think I gravitate to work and labor history, and it's one thing that I always kind of come back to. I mean, obviously, the first research project that I did, the first book, We Were All Like Migrant Workers Here, was very much about Native peoples as migrant farm workers in California. And I hope to, you know, when I wrote that book, I hope to kind of contribute to that kind of larger narrative that we have in California about the role of farm workers, you know, dating back to Cary McWilliams, but also a variety of works that have kind of positioned California and discussed the history of California farm workers. And, you know, growing up in Round Valley and in Mendocino County, I was very, you know, my dad is still a rancher. There's times when I go home once a summer and help my dad bale and work in the hay industry, bale hay, for a week. So, I mean, I've always thought and kind of admired that kind of that history of work and labor that exists here and that exists in the state of California. Interestingly, though, I was also drawn to this project in terms of work and labor. In addition to say kind of the history of work and labor, and also to using oral history and oral history methods in my research, I've always been kind of attracted or kind of drawn to the era of the 1930s and the Great Depression. What my first project, I thought I was going to write a history of the Indian, an act called the Indian Reorganization Act in California, as one of my projects. And I've always kind of had this kind of attachment to the 1930s and the Great Depression era. And so when I kind of found these oral histories and oral traditions that were located in the Bancroft Library, and I understood that they were part of a public works project that was created during the Great Depression to put, you know, everyday people back to work, I thought it was kind of a nice way to kind of connect my two interests, or my varied interests.
Right. And now you've maybe wrong about this, you've moved on to more general themes in California Indian history or Native history. Maybe you could give us a broader picture of the scope of that work the whole state time.
There's actually two projects. There's two things that I've been working on in that regard. I mean, I think this one right now, Indigenizing California History, is trying to be a much more kind of comprehensive, or as comprehensive as I can, look at California Indians in the 1930s. And so one of the kind of unique aspects, I think, of this project that I really like is that you have Native peoples in California, in Mendocino County, being interviewed at roughly the same time that Native peoples in the Owens Valley are being interviewed. And so we can kind of compare and contrast how Native peoples in Mendocino County thought about their past at the same time that Paiutes in the Owens Valley kind of thought about were thinking about their past, present, and future. You know, obviously, I did find some similarities in this project, but also I was also struck by the way in which kind of the different histories of even the Owens Valley and in Mendocino County shaped the way in which Native peoples talked about their past, present, and future. You know, one of the big events in the Owens Valley, obviously, is the kind of the draining of the Owens Valley in the early 20th century, when the city of Los Angeles began to buy up land and water rights in the Owens Valley and siphoned all the water down into southern California. And very often when we see depictions of this in movies, such as the 1970s film Chinatown, or even a lot of many of the historical narratives that we have about this important event in California history, the Paiute population in the state, in the Owens Valley, is often ignored. They're often treated as if that they don't exist. But by reading their oral traditions, it is very clear that they're thinking about issues related to water, and they're also thinking about kind of the impact. What's this going to mean to their way of life? What happens if all of the water leaves? Obviously, there's going to be kind of an economic impact. But many Paiutes considered themselves, the people next to the river. And so, if that river dries up, what does that mean for their locus of identity and how they understand them and how they understand themselves? And so, that's kind of one way in which I've been, thinking about American Indian issues more broadly in the state. And then I've also been working on with a co-author. His name is Damon Akins. He teaches at Guilford College in North Carolina. And Damon and I met in graduate school at the University of Oklahoma, and we're working on a co-written kind of overview or textbook about California Indians. And we titled that tentatively right now, "We Use the Land." And part of what we're trying to argue here is looking at the different ways in which, over time, California Indians have used land and place to reinvent themselves, given the variety of historical changes that have occurred in the state.
Okay.
How did Native peoples in Southern California and along the coast use place and land to reimagine their identities during, say, the Spanish mission period, or even after Mexican independence? And then kind of this book will try to be as comprehensive as possible, dating back to how California Indians understood their creation and come up to present-day issues related to, say, Indian gaming and tribal sovereignty.
Okay, and I think the lay people out here, like myself, we sort of know that there were lots of different groups and languages and cultures in California. I'm not asking for an index here, but could you give us an idea of just how many different groups and language cultures, or what kind of differences you're talking about when you take on a big subject like this?
If you look on a map, I mean, it's always kind of stunning. If we look on a map, I mean, California is often depicted as one of the most diverse indigenous places in North America. And language is not always the best way, I think, to kind of categorize Native peoples. But, I mean, it is a useful way of looking at the indigenous past in the state. There were upwards of eight large language families depicted that were spoken in the state. And very often there were, individual, even within kind of language families, there were regional dialects. Mendocino County is centered in the homeland of the Pomo people. So the Pomo language was spoken throughout what is now Mendocino County. But even people who lived on the Pomo-speaking people who lived on the coast might speak a little bit different version of the language than those Pomo-speaking peoples who lived near Clear Lake, for instance. And so it's very much this kind of very incredibly kind of diverse situation. And part of that stemmed from the fact that California Indians tended to live in smaller communities and villages that were linked to one another through kinship, intermarriage patterns, and also trade and exchange relationships. And so it's always been kind of it's always been a kind of landscape of villages that were kind of held together by a common language, but also their abilities to kind of create relationships with their neighbors and their and other peoples.
Mm-hmm. And often, in looking at these subjects, one finds the beginning dates around the middle of the 19th century. Your book, I think, did it begin in 1841, or was it 1850?
1850.
And you mentioned your source, Lucy, talking about that beginning period as well. Is there anything that's of particular interest to you about the transition from a territory that was to whatever degree dominated by Mexico and the coming of the Yankees, I guess?
Yeah, so normally when in California history, just to kind of provide a short overview of this, there's usually about three important periodizations. There's usually it's 1769 with the arrival of the Spanish and the creation of the mission system from, say, you know, modern-day San Diego up to the modern-day San Francisco Bay Area. There's 1821, where is the transition from kind of Spanish to Mexican, you know, political authority. And then, of course, as you noted earlier with Lucy Young's quote, you know, the late 1840s, especially, say, 1848 and 1849 with the California Gold Rush and then the end of the Mexican-American War, when we see the transition to United States political authority. And so there was, you know, in California, and obviously from Lucy's perspective and many other kind of California Indian communities, you know, those years of the late 1840s are really significant because not only do we have a different nation state claiming authority over California, the United States interacted with indigenous peoples very differently than Spain and Mexico had. For instance, there were, under Mexico, indigenous peoples were citizens of the state, whereas in the 1840s and 1850s, American Indians and indigenous peoples within the United States were not often citizens. And so there's that political authority changes in the 1840s, but also kind of the rapid influx of people that occurs because of the California Gold Rush, which radically kind of transformed, how the state was. I mean, you know, mostly during the Spanish and Mexican periods, most of the settlements tended to be more on the coast. They only reached, say, as far as Solano and kind of the Bay Area was kind of the extent of Spanish and Mexican settlements. And very often they didn't go into the interior. Well, with the California Gold Rush, now we have people establishing towns and cities throughout the center of California, and it was also this kind of rapid change. Hmm. It happened so quickly that California Indians experienced a lot of kind of fundamental changes to their lives, as Lucy kind of pointed out.
Okay, now another area of your interest, I think you told me, was the issue involving federal projects, and I think you have said you've been looking into what you called resistance to these projects, especially by the Pomo people.
Yeah, I think that's related to the project that I'm, this kind of the book Indigenizing California and the way in which, you know, Pomo people are kind of retelling their own, are participating in that retelling of California's history.
Okay.
You know, for instance, I mean, one of the great stories is that this one woman told a story, and her name was Susie Wattin, and she told this story about the creation of Blue Lakes, which is kind of over near Clear Lake. If you go by it off of when you travel Highway 20, mm-hmm. In between the Highway 101 and I-5, if you have to make that that trip over to the Central Valley. And one of the things that she did very kind of evocatively, she kind of told this very long story about the kind of the creation of the lakes and Pomo kind of understandings of the lands around that. But she ended by saying that this proves that Pomos were the first pioneers in this area, and they were the first people on the frontier. And in in the 1930s, and even now, those are pretty loaded terms. You know, pioneer and frontier are these words that have been used to kind of mostly look at the way in which Anglo-Americans have advanced and moved westward.
Mm-hmm.
But by co-opting and taking those words for her own, Susie was able to, again, kind of make an important claim on California's history and also on the history of the American West or even the history of the United States. She invested her own meanings in those two terms and kind of used them for her own purposes to make a claim, to make a distinct kind of Pomo claim on the lakes and the water of Mendocino County.
And the federal projects, remind us of what they were, if there's resistance to them?
Many of the federal projects included, say, the move to, you know, the move to reservations. There's also efforts in the 1930s to kind of used to take native lands away from them and then hold them in trust. So many in the late 19th and even into the early 20th centuries, Pomo people in Mendocino County would pick hops. They would pool all their money, and then they would buy their own small land plots throughout Northern California. And there was a move in the early 20th century then to transfer title of that land from individual private title or community title to kind of a federal trust relationship where the federal government holds this land in trust. And many Pomo people kind of attempted to resist that and claim that the lands on their own, that their own kind of labor had purchased these small pieces of property. And so I think one of the things that Pomos and many other Native peoples are doing when they tell their oral traditions is they often would name specific places on the map. And by naming those places, they claim that land and those places as their own. And so I think that these are kind of these related efforts to resist federal efforts and federal projects to kind of take away Native lands in Northern California.
And do these names still exist? Do we...
The place names, many of the place names, they do exist. My Pomo language is always kind of I'm always hesitant to kind of speak that language because I'm not a fluent speaker in Pomo. But, you know, for instance, Concal people from Northern California, say over near the Chico area, mm-hmm. would refer to our the presently named area, Lassen Peak or Mount Lassen. That was called West Mountain for them. And they called it that because it was, that was one place, that was a kind of the border of their territory, that they knew that was one place from over, they could not move beyond because then they would run into other people live beyond West Mountain. But it's also, if we kind of think about it, it positions us, it puts us more in the center of Pomo territory. If we have to call a mountain West Mountain, then we have to kind of see it from a certain vantage point. And so there's a story about the coming of fire in which a figure, Lizard, kind of sees smoke coming up from West Mountain. And one of the best times that she sees it is when the sun, right, sets behind that mountain. And so I think by kind of thinking about some of these native place names, we kind of position ourselves in the center of native territories, and we begin to kind of look outwards. And once we kind of do that, I think we can kind of tell and appreciate a different kind of California history. You know, for instance, you know, often when California history is told and discussed, it's centered in places like San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, sure. San Diego. When we begin to look at the history of the state from a native perspective, we begin to kind of put ourselves near places like West Mountain or another one that Concals used was Middle Mountain for present-day Sutter's Buttes. You know, we begin to kind of position ourselves on that landscape, and then I think we can kind of tell and think about the state's history in a different and in unique way.
Okay. I'll pause again here and tell listeners this is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio, and I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. And our program is an antinomian hour, and our guest today is Professor William Bauer, Jr., a professor of history at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And very lucky we are indeed to have Professor Bauer with us. Well, here's a different kind of a question. What do you like about teaching, and what would you like your students to be able to take away from your classes if you had your choice. How about that?
This is one of the neat things, right? So the semester for us has just begun, and I'm getting slowly, but getting in back into the teaching groove after the summer. One of the things I most appreciate about students, and this has been at places I've taught at three, and I've taught in four different places. I've taught in Oklahoma. I've taught in Wyoming. I taught once in California, and I've taught here in Las Vegas for many years. And one of the things that I appreciate most about students is one, they keep you young, right? I mean, you're mostly interacting with 18 to 22 year olds. And that's always going to stay the same, and so it kind of keeps you young and keeps you kind of on top of certain things, and you kind of get that enthusiasm from them. But one of the other things that I really appreciate about them is how open-minded students have been. I mean, I teach sometimes, and some people always kind of think about American Indian history, for instance. It's a pretty tough subject to listen to. They kind of think it can be a depressing narrative. Sometimes people focus on what happens to Native peoples and the loss of land and the population decline and those related issues. I always appreciate their ability to kind of think outside the box over time and begin to kind of think about different ways of thinking about and understanding American Indian people. And when I start talking, one of the things that I always talk about in my first day of class, for instance, is I don't often use the word tribes. I use nations when I teach American Indian history, because it reflects the modern day development of tribal sovereignty in that Native peoples possess. So those are some of the things that I try to kind of get them to kind of think about, and they're often very kind of open-minded about those approaches. And one of the things that I always appreciate kind of at the end of a semester is, it's not a large number, but often students come up to me at the end and say, wow, I really enjoyed this class because you kind of taught the topic in such a way that I'd never heard things before. I'd never heard the stories and the history told in this fashion. And so they're always kind of, that's one thing I always kind of appreciate. And that's also maybe one thing that I'd like them to get from the class, too. I want them to kind of leave the class with a different understanding what they came in. Obviously, came into the class with. Very often students might have a perception of American Indian history that they get from, say, Western movies or dime novels. I mean, there's still that kind of perspective that people will bring into the class. And so I really try to debunk those notions. I mean, so I make the point that American Indian history isn't only in the 19th century. We devote a third of my class, say, to the development to 20th century American Indian history. And then I also want them to leave with some kind of grounding and some understanding of tribal sovereignty, and that Native nations have kind of an inherent right of self-rule that is not granted by an entity like the United States, but is inherent by the fact that American Indians were distinct political entities before the arrival of Europeans, and they continue to be so today, and they can govern themselves. And so when we talk about things like Indian gaming, for instance, that's not the United States does not bestow that right on Native peoples. Native peoples possess the ability to govern their own gaming institutions on their own, and they possess their own ability to operate their own schools and these kind of other and healthcare and clinics and that sort of thing. And so I want them to kind of leave my class with this notion of sovereignty.
And so nation.
Third, I like them to kind of think about the diversity of Indian country. I mean, your question earlier about how California, about California Indian peoples and how diverse they are, that affects people across the country. And so. There might be some similarities between the people from the Round Valley Reservation and, say, Lakotas in South Dakota, but they also have very different and unique experiences, too. And so I hope that students kind of understand that diversity of experiences. There's no one American Indian story. There's many stories out there that we need to respect and understand.
And so nation takes us in that direction as opposed to, say,
absolutely,
tribe.
Yeah. I mean, so each tribal government has their own different political systems. They have their own areas in which they exercise sovereignty, and it varies across the United States.
So we could say the Pomo Nation as opposed to a band of Pomos, or...
Yeah, well, and that's kind of one of the interesting things, right? I mean, there's even different kind of Pomo reservations throughout Mendocino and Lake counties, and they're all, you know, they're all related to one another, but they also possess their own kind of inherent sovereignty mm-hmm. that allows them to kind of operate their own entities, their own places. So for instance, there's Coyote Valley and there's Pinoleville, and they're related to one another, but they're also kind of independent. They also function independently of the other as well.
Okay, and do you get many Indian students in your classes?
I typically have two or three every semester. When I taught in Wyoming, I would have maybe a little more just because the reservation, the Wind River Reservation, was a little bit bigger and sent a few more students to the University of Wyoming. Here in Las Vegas, there are Paiute reservations. There's a Paiute reservation in the city of Las Vegas, and then there's one nearby. The Moapa Paiute Reservation, but we do get a lot of Diné students from the Navajo Nation, so we're able to kind of attract a good number of students from across across the Southwest.
Are there any programs that strive to bring Indian youngsters into higher education?
Absolutely. There's been a long-standing relationship between the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and the Navajo Nation to provide tuition assistance for Navajo students who want to come to UNLV. And then on campus, we have there's a faculty group of which I'm a member of, the American Indian Alliance. And then the last semester, we actually created for the first time an American Indian and Indigenous Studies minor. So students can minor in American Indian and Indigenous Studies. And it's the first program of this kind in the state of Nevada. Uh-huh. So that's something, that we're quite proud of, that we're giving students an intellectual hub. You know, when they can come to UNLV, they know that their ways of thinking are going to be taught and understood and kind of appreciated and disseminated throughout the university. And so people can come here and kind of understand the American Indian past, present, and future.
Okay. It seems to me that it'd be fair to say that the Indian peoples, nations of Northern California have been much involved in environmental movements up here. And I wondered if you would think that that was the case and maybe give us some ideas about why that would be so.
Well, I think one of the kind of the important things that occurs there is there's always been this deep relationship to the land, to the place of Northern California. And I don't want to veer off too much in this notion of this of kind of the what has been called the ecological Indian, in that I'm not saying that so Native peoples have a specific and distinct relationship with land and place that kind of informs their understanding of their role in the movement of in kind of the environmental movement here. Many California Indian oral traditions, for instance, or their creation stories, begin with their creation a very specific place. And in order to could persist as a people over time, they had to maintain distinct relationships with that place, and very much kind of this notion of kind of give and take. If we take care of the land will take care of us. And so that's always been kind of embedded in Northern California Indian understandings of the land. And so... protecting, forests, salmon, steelhead runs, those kind of things are vitally important to American Indian people. But it's also, also important to the exercise of American Indian sovereignty and the ways in which California Indians can still manage these important resources that we possess in the state of California.
Yeah, there's just recently been water issues in the Willits area.
Exactly right. I mean, given the fact that the drought the state is in, I mean, maybe we should include more kind of Native voices in these debates about kind of maintaining that, what kind of relationships between people and water. Paiutes, obviously, as I mentioned earlier in the interview, kind of were thinking about, kind of thought about their creation as being related to water, and the Pomo story but from Susie Wathin that I talked about a little earlier, talked about that, the position and the centrality of bodies of water and their understandings of the world.
Okay, and Willie, you mentioned gaming earlier on, and I think you've been doing some work there. Do you have a word of explanation about your interest and what's happening?
Absolutely. It's obviously, I think, one of the big issues that is in California, even nationwide, involves Indian gaming. And so this semester I'm teaching a class for the first time at UNLV called American Indian Gaming. And I mean, one of the reasons I did so is that very often students come into American Indian history classes and they very often approach the class from what they see in the media. And so I could reference this a little earlier, but many students only have kind of an understanding of American Indian history from the perspective of kind of Western movies or dime novels, and that's one area in which they get their understanding of American Indians. But also, I think increasingly in media that American Indians are portrayed as being connected to casinos, and so if we see American Indians in, say, TV sitcoms, I don't know if listeners who may have seen kind of Parks and Recreation, The Simpsons, Family Guy, even going back to the HBO program The Sopranos, whenever Native people showed up, they always did so in connection to a casino. And so one of the things that I want to do for my students here is, one, to kind of interrogate these images, is why are Native peoples only being connected to casinos, and what kind of stories do we get by looking at Native peoples in relationship to these businesses. And also, I want students to have to leave my class with a better understanding of the history of Indian gaming. Why does it develop? Under what circumstances does it? And what does it mean, again, kind of for the future of California, also the United States? But this is it's an enormous issue in the state. I mean, I think many people tend to be very kind of supportive of Indian gaming, but whenever Native groups want to build a casino, I mean, it does create a lot of uproar and debate throughout the state for many of these communities. And so it's one of these big issues that I think we need, that I want students to leave my class with a better understanding of why they exist and these debates and these discussions about gaming.
Okay, and why they exist? What do you say about that?
Well, I think it goes back to one of the themes that I want students to leave my class with. I mean, it goes back to sovereignty. These are businesses. American Indians are sovereign. They practice this kind of form of this self-determination where they can kind of govern themselves and figure out what they want to do for the future. Very often, one of the ideal kind of economic enterprises that we've seen since the 1970s is going into gaming and establishing casino resorts. Now, obviously, it's not the only panacea. Some of these casinos fail; they're not positioned in the right place. But we do see so many successes that they're a kind of a viable economic entity, and they become kind of self-perpetuating too, is with casino, with gaming revenues. Native peoples can invest more in developing land and doing other businesses. They also can provide more different kinds of healthcare, educational offerings to Native students, and engage in kind of cultural revitalization. Hire people to work on language revitalization projects and the like, and so the really strong and casinos have done, I think, a lot of good for Native peoples, and also they've done a lot of good for the surrounding non-Native communities. Very often, many of these casino resorts have to hire non-Native peoples in order to staff positions, and so that kind of raises employment rates in the area. Not all the tourist dollars that go into the casino are going only into the casino, and so other businesses around the casino can also generate revenue as well. And so, I mean, I think I understand the kind of the controversy, but I think that also there are enormous benefits that redound onto native and non-native peoples in the nearby areas.
Okay, and I have a kind of a personal question sure. for you, if you don't mind, or you can mind. But I have your CV, curriculum vitae, sitting in front of me, and I have to say it's very much more than packed full. So I can't believe that you get much time to get home. But have you been able to maintain your family and community ties with the Round Valley?
Actually, I do. One of the things that I'm most happy about when I moved to Las Vegas about 5 years ago is that I'm a lot closer to home. And so I warned my mom and dad is that I'm close enough to be home. I'm close enough to Covelo now that I can actually be home in time for dinner. It's a bit of a stretch. It's a 12-hour drive, but I can be there. I can be in Covelo in about 12 to 13-hour drive. And a flight is a little easier sometimes. But I do make an effort to come home at least once a year. Typically early in the summer, as I said earlier, I go home and I help my dad on his ranch. He puts me to work driving a tractor for about 12 hours a day, which is going to get me back to my agricultural and working class roots a little bit. And I really enjoy that, and it's a good way to kind of see people and connect. And one of the events that I did last year that's also kind of that's coming up in the next couple of weeks is last year I participated in the first time in an event called the Gnome Cult Walk. And this is an annual event in which people from the Round Valley Reservation and also some native communities over in the Central Valley commemorate the forced removal or the ethnic cleansing of Concow people from the area, say, around Chico and Oroville to the Round Valley Reservation. And so in the middle of the Civil War, native Concows were forcibly marched by the United States Army from the Chico area over the mountains to the Round Valley Reservation. And this cost almost half the people who began the walk died en route. So it's a rather horrific event in California and in Concow and California Indian history. And so in the last couple years, 20 years, people have been making this commemorative walk, and so they will start walking in near, say, Colusa, I believe, and then we'll spend a week walking from Colusa to Covelo. And so last year I did not participate in the entire event, but I met my whole family came to Covelo, and we participated in the last 2 days of the walk. And so we met them at the top of the North Coast Range outside of Round Valley up near, if people are familiar with Round Valley. We met them near Anthony's Peak, and then we walked from the top of the mountain all the way to the tribal headquarters. And so it took about 2 days to do that, and we were pretty spent at the end of the time. But it was another good event that I will try to go back to as many times as I possibly can. It's coming up in the next couple weeks, but my schedule is getting a little tight. That's an event that's high on my list.
Are the schools or the young people involved in things?
Yeah,
like
the schools, the young people mostly participate. Some kids did the entire walk. Took the week off of school. But very often, more of them will show up, say on Friday and on Saturday to participate at once the school began. School lets out.
Okay.
And actually, last year when I participated. I did so because my two aunts told me that I had to go. They did the whole, my two of my aunts and a couple of my cousins did the whole walk, and I know that they thoroughly enjoyed their time. So,
okay, Willie, one last question. We don't have too much time, but when you were talking about the oral histories taken in the 1930s, you talked about people imagining futures. And my mentor, I think you know him or of him, the late Edward Thompson, frequently referred to the need to renew our moral imagination, to be willing to think about the future and what we might like. And I wondered if you ever allowed yourself to think along those lines, or if the people you work with ever do. What kind of a future do you think people might think about here in Mendocino County? And
yeah, I mean, you know, maybe from a Native perspective, I think one of the things that always struck me, you know, in these interviews, like I've said before, I mean, they're very much thinking about what's going to go on after their, you know, the interview is done, and they try to project forward. And one of the things that kind of came up, at least in the 1930s, is that there were many of these stories about, when they would begin to tell the story, that they would talk about these very seemingly powerless people or small, diminutive people. But in the end, these seemingly powerless people come to possess great power and often kind of change the course of history or change the course of the narrative. And so that's one of the things that I've always kind of gravitated to, you know, this idea that grassroots people, you know, everyday people, working class people, have the ability to kind of shape their own, you know, shape their futures. And we're not always kind of the pawns of these kind of larger forces that that affect us. And you know, kind of everyday people can shape. Throughout history, we've seen everyday people being able to kind of shape events and making things kind of better for the better going forward. And I always, you know, the other thing that I always think about too that seems to kind of resonate here, at least especially again from a Native perspective, is the relationship to place and land and thinking about, you know, protecting some of these places and some of these sites that Native peoples have always kind of considered important. And once we begin to do that, Native communities, I think, you know, retaining and rebuilding on that connection to place can have, I think, powerful social and political and economic benefits when we think about that, kind of making sure that we give back, we give to place, and then the place will help us and protect us as well.
Willie, that's all the time we have today, but I want to thank you very much, very much. This is Professor William Bauer, Jr., we've been talking to today. He's the professor of history at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas. He's a native of the Round Valley here in Mendocino County. It's been very informative, a great pleasure to talk to you, Willie. I hope we can do it again, and then I should thank listeners, as usual, for tuning in and say that this is Cal Winslow with an Antinomian Hour, and I'll be back next week at the same time. So good afternoon.